Good evening, everybody. Very nice to welcome you all here to the LSE. This is vacation time, so I'm surprised to see such a good number of people here this evening. And we're here to listen to some magical words from the next director of the LSE, Sir Howard Davis, and we're delighted to welcome you here this evening, Howard. First of all, may I say this, that the lecture is being held under the auspices of the Lawyers Group of Alumni, run by our own David Goldstone, and we put on occasions such as this in the course of the year, and we have a very active Lawyers Group in the school, because contrary to the title of the place, we actually have some extremely good lawyers here, so it's not just about economics and other social sciences. Indeed, I doubt very much if this place could survive without the input it gets from the law department. Next, I should tell you straight away that there will be a post-lecture reception in the Robinson Room, which I think from memory is on the third floor.
Second.
It used to be. It's third. In your day, it was the second floor, Robin. It's now the third floor. And everybody, of course, is welcome to join us at that reception. Next, I want specifically to thank the chambers of my learned friend Robin Potts, QC, Erskine Chambers. They practice, broadly speaking, in company law, and you're very welcome to get to instruct them at any stage you like, preferably through a solicitor, with a willingness to spend a great deal of money to secure the advice that you will get from those chambers. But we are very grateful to them for having supported very generously this evening, and we're actually very thrilled that they have agreed to participate both in the support of the lecture and in support of the post-lecture reception. I'm asked here to give a good plug to those chambers. Why I should, because it's entirely inconsistent with my own position, but nevertheless I'm happy to do so. Now that brings me to Howard Davis. We are very thrilled indeed to know that he's going to be the next director of the LSE, and I'm sure he's going to make his mark. He's an entirely different character from his immediate predecessor, and that's probably a good thing, because it'll bring a different angle to the needs of the school. And he's coming to the school at a very, very important moment in its time. And I want to take this opportunity of wishing him all the best for the future and for this period of appointment, because we're as excited about his arrival here as I know he is about coming here. I can tell a little story. I probably shouldn't be telling it, because he told me it in confidence, but what the hell. But the story goes something along these lines, that he first spoke to his wife, Prue, and he said, "Well, you'll be impressed, I've been appointed to run the Audit Commission." And she said, "Well, what's that?" And you can imagine what then ensued for several minutes. And she listened impassively and said, "That sounds terribly boring." And then at some later stage in his career, or it may have been earlier because I probably got this the wrong way around, he said, "Well, I'm going to go and run the Bank of England." And she said, "Well, tell me about that." And he spent several minutes explaining what was expected to be involved in that task. She said, "That sounds even more boring than the Audit Commission." And then he said very grandly one day, "But now," he said, "I'm going to be running the FSA." She said, "Tell me something about that." And you can imagine that conversation. And she said, "You know, it just gets worse." And then he came along and he said, "But now I'm going to be the director of the London School of Economics." And she said, "That is a job." Now this lecture that Howard is about to deliver has got a very arrogant title. It is Five Lessons for Lawyers. I've never met a lawyer who could ever take a lesson. But to take five is very demanding, but I will do my best. And I'm sure most people here will as well. Can we give a warm welcome to Howard Davis?
Thank Well, thank you very much, Tony, for that introduction. And it's useful for me and perhaps for some of you to know what client confidentiality means in your chambers. Now, sadly, the story is more or less true with a little bit of poetic license. But I have to admit this evening to being somewhat intimidated by the prospect of talking to an audience of LSE lawyers, because I'm well aware of the strong legal tradition in the school, which of course is currently symbolised by the chairmanship of a distinguished Tilk. And I'm also conscious of the fact that the intellectual foundations of financial regulation in the United Kingdom were, in a sense, established here, because it remains true that the single clearest and most persuasive expression of the intellectual justification for our approach to financial regulation in this country was contained in Professor Gower's review of investor protection in 1981. And Jim Gower, as I understand it, was a professor at the LSE in the early part of his career. And there are two more recent connections between the school and financial regulation. My general counsel, Andrew Whittaker, who is here in order to ensure that I do not misspeak myself this evening, spoke at a seminar organised by the LSE just a few months ago, looking at the implicit regulation involved in contract law and the impact on the development of regulatory policy. Now he, I hope, is competent to do battle with the legal fraternity at the school. He always tells me he is, whether students, lecturers or alumni, whereas I, by contrast, am strictly an amateur in these complex matters and indeed in much else. When it comes to the law, I don't know much about it, though I do know what I like, and indeed what I don't like, as a matter of fact. But so, speaking from a determinedly amateur perspective this evening, I would like to offer a few reflections on lessons which I have learned from 6 years in charge of financial regulation in London, and points which I hope will be of some interest to lawyers. And when I say a few, I mean, as Tony suggested, precisely five. And I hope that giving you this certainty about the scale of my presentation will ease the nervousness which is bound to be felt by those of you who are programmed to calculate the opportunity cost of billings foregone as you listen. However, before I launch into my 5 points, just a few words about the FSA and its construction. Its birth was announced by Gordon Brown in 1997 as the other side of the coin of Bank of England independence. And many people thought that this interest in the regulation of the city was a slightly odd priority for what was then the first week of office of a centre-left government. But of course, since then, we have learned that this is an odd centre-left government. Centre-left in the particular sense of centre-right, perhaps. But the way this construction was put together was the old Securities and Investments Board, which was what I was technically appointed chairman of at the time, and I used that as a kind of takeover vehicle for integrating all of the other regulators. And in fact, that was done by a rather inventive approach, which was in fact dreamt up by the then General Counsel, whom of course we had to get rid of at that point, but who invented the idea that we could construct a single regulator on a contractual basis ahead of the legislation, something which no other country has attempted to do, but which actually worked quite well. We renamed the SIB the FSA in the autumn of 97, and then all of the sort of 10 regulatory bodies we merged came together on the 1st of June 1998, so we are just 5 years old. That managerial integration took place ahead of the legislation, and the draft Financial Services and Markets Bill wasn't published until July of 98, but not enacted until July 2000, and not implemented until December 2001, which we called with the code name N2. So we have only 18 months' experience of the new regime in all its glory. And indeed, I have to say there are elements of it still to come. We'll be taking on mortgage regulation and general insurance regulation in October 2004 and January 2005, respectively. And indeed, I would say there are possibilities that the organization would expand further beyond there. One of the things that I have found at the FSA is one of the risks of a single regulator is that setting up a kind of compendium, an omnibus body of this kind, is a bit like putting a skip outside your house in London, where, as you know, the first thing that happens if you get some building work done, you put a skip outside, is that other people put their rubbish in it. And the danger of running the FSA is that other ministers and other departments think, we've got a problem, why don't we dump it on them? So there's a scope for further expansion, I suspect, but for the moment we have a coverage ranging from banks and insurance companies through the broking fund management community into financial advisors. We're also the listing authority now and the authority that investigates market abuse, and we have a very broad range of powers in the legal area. We can operate through our disciplinary regime with our own fining and suspension powers, or we can be civil prosecutors, or we can be criminal prosecutors, and all of these responsibilities were put within the one organisation in order to maximise the chances that the right route was chosen in the event of some kind of malpractice in financial markets. So we've been in existence only with our full powers for 18 months. But although the experience of the new system is short, I think it isn't too early to offer some observations about how it's working. Which brings me to my first point, which is that in my view, the unusually protracted parliamentary process did leave us with a good quality piece of legislation. Now, the parliamentary process that we went through was protracted, and I have to say, at the time, it was quite difficult to see the benefits of it, because we were engaged in parliamentary processes for fully 2 years. And indeed, the Financial Services and Markets Act has the unwanted accolade of being the most amended piece of parliamentary legislation in British history. More than 1,000 amendments were accepted during the course of the passage of the Act. But that was partly because it was subject to a number of interesting constitutional innovations. Not all of them were absolutely new, but some of them were, and the combination certainly was. In the first place, as I've said, the bill was published in draft for consultation. The consultation process was lengthy and intense. There were many times when I and my lawyers could have wished it otherwise, but it certainly meant that a large number of issues were aired at an early stage. And by the end of the process, I think it's true to say at least that everybody involved felt they'd had their say. And the result is that legislation which was highly controversial when first drafted and published has been so far much less controversial in its operation. And that, I think, is the right way round. A second related innovation was that the Act was one of the first pieces of public law to be carried over from one parliamentary session to another, following the recommendations of the Modernisation of Parliament Committee in 1998. These were little noticed recommendations at the time because the Modernisation of Parliament Committee also dealt with matters like creches in the Palace of Westminster, and which attracted rather more public attention. But they recommended that public bills could, by agreement with the opposition, be carried over from one session to another if they were not completed. Now, carryover depends on the approval of the opposition, which was forthcoming in this case, albeit not without some horse trading. And there's clearly a risk that the government of the day is obliged to make undesirable concessions as a result of putting this card in the hands of the opposition. But in this case, there were no concessions which fundamentally damaged the legislation, so I would count the carryover process to have been a success. And it avoided the hasty, hectic lawmaking which often arises as the end of a session deadline approaches, and which can, I think, be particularly damaging for technical pieces of legislation. The legislation was also subject to another constitutional innovation in the form of review by a joint committee of both Houses of Parliament, in this case chaired by Lord Burns, a former permanent secretary to the Treasury, but including eminent members of Parliament and the House of Lords. Now, that pre-legislative scrutiny, in my view, certainly added value and teased out a number of complex issues which would have otherwise detained Parliament and would have been more difficult to deal with in the traditional confrontational style of Westminster politics. The issue, for example, of regulatory statutory immunity was dealt with by the Burns Committee. In my view, and I believe Lord Burns himself shares this, the committee could have been even more useful had it been given more time to operate. Some uncertainties about the committee's composition, its chairmanship, and its procedures delayed its start in a rather tiresome way. But I'm convinced that this was also a useful constitutional innovation, and I'm pleased to say that it is now being followed in some, but not all, bills for which it might be appropriate. In fact, most recently in Lord Slynn's committee on the draft anti-corruption bill. Yet another innovative element which caused some difficulties at the time was the need for certification by ministers that the legislation was compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights, which they had very recently brought home by incorporating it into our domestic legal system. And ours was the first major piece of legislation to require certification in this sense. And you can imagine how delighted I was to be told that when this news first became clear. Because, of course, nobody quite knew what it entailed, and it entered a whole new piece of element of uncertainty into the legislative process. But there are those who still believe that our procedures could be subject to challenge on this score, though I note that no challenge has yet been forthcoming. And indeed, a couple of challenges on human rights grounds to the procedures of one of the previous regulators have not been sustained. However, we are not complacent on this score. One of our French opposite numbers, the Commission des Opérations de Bourse, lost all of their current disciplinary cases as a result of a challenge on human rights grounds, the Uri case, for those who are interested. We think we are well protected against that particular challenge, which overturned the French procedures, but I'm sure that inventive legal minds, if that's not an oxymoron, are even now thinking of ways to raise the issue again. Lastly, in terms of legislative innovation, the Act is, unlike the regulatory statutes it replaced, purposive in nature. By that I mean that it begins with a set of four statutory objectives which the FSA is obliged to pursue, which are themselves conditioned by a series of what we know as the principles of good regulation. I don't think they're actually called that, technically speaking, in the Act, but that's the way we think of them. And those objectives are four. They are maintaining confidence in the financial system, protecting consumers of financial services, bearing in mind their own responsibilities for informing themselves about the decisions they plan to make, promoting public understanding of the financial system, and the rather heroic objective of reducing financial crime, which I think was put in by the Treasury as a kind of joke. And the principles of good regulation include proportionality, the need to meet a cost-benefit test in any rules we put forward, the need to avoid unnecessarily damaging competition and innovation and all that. Now, I don't retail these in order to give you a test on them later, but just to explain, broadly speaking, the architecture of the legislation. And in fact, we have found this framework of objectives and principles to be most helpful. In the past, financial regulation legislation typically gave powers to the Bank of England or whoever, but did not, in fact, explain what those powers were to be exercised for. And we have found that a purposive piece of legislation of this kind is very helpful. And indeed, we have built the corporate strategy of the institution and indeed our operating procedures around them, something which I think is relatively unusual. I mean, certainly it's unusual in the financial regulatory world internationally, which we know reasonably well, because these principles of regulation can in fact be used as a kind of checklist, more or less in that form, for our board when we are inviting them to make a rule or change a rule. We can actually show them how we have analysed its purposes in relation to the objectives, and also how we have analysed it against the principles of good regulation. So my conclusion is that, partly because of the constitutional innovations to which it was subject, the new legislation looks pretty good so far. We have found relatively few problems in operating it, certainly no insuperable technical obstacles. There are those who believe that there are faults with it. For example, there are those on the consumer side who believe that it overconstrains the regulator in terms of publicising enforcement actions. Certainly we are more constrained than many of our overseas counterparts, and that's an issue which may be reviewed when the government carries out a kind of 3,000-mile service of the Act around the end of this year. But frankly, I would be surprised if a strong case were to be mounted for any fundamental revision of the statute at that time. Indeed, we have seen suggestions that elements of the system might, with benefit, be adapted elsewhere. Anne Abraham, when Legal Services Ombudsman, suggested that the regulation of legal services should be reformed and noted that the FSA provided an obvious model against which to benchmark the current regulatory maze. Whether the government plans to take up that challenge, I wouldn't like to say. That sounds like a good topic for the Lord High Executioner, or whatever Lord Faulkner is now called. However, and this is my second point, the Financial Services and Markets Act is not the only influence on the development of financial regulation in the UK. Indeed, possibly a more fundamental influence at present is the European Commission's Financial Sector Action Plan, a programme of some 42 directives and regulations, which was agreed in principle by heads of government at the European Summit in Lisbon 3 years or so ago. Now, it's not my intention this evening either to question the overall aim of the FSAP or to discuss individual measures within it. I'm personally quite happy with the notion of a single European capital market, which provides, or should provide, enhanced opportunities for investors to find assets which best suit their preferences, and also better access to capital by companies, which ought in principle to reduce the cost of capital for European companies, and that also ought to be an economic advantage. My concern, however, is twofold. First, the European legislative programme does not emerge in a simple and coherent way. And second, in some respects, it cuts across the disciplines built into our own legislation. Now, to be scrupulously fair, I ought to amplify that first point a little. The Financial Sector Action Plan itself is planned in a broadly coherent and systematic way by DG Markt in the Commission, which is the single market part of the Commission. Unfortunately, other legislative initiatives which affect financial markets also emerge from other parts of the Commission. For example, the e-commerce directive, which is of general application, affects the marketing of financial products and services in a particular way, along with other things. The proposed duty not to trade unfairly, which has emerged from the consumer protection part of the Commission, would similarly affect financial markets and could cut across some of the provisions in our law to protect investors under the Investment Services Directive. The Distance Marketing Directive is another which was conceived elsewhere in the Commission, yet which affects financial markets. And the Consumer Credit Directive, which you in your innocent way might have thought would be part of the Financial Sector Action Plan, is in fact a quite separate initiative emerging from the Consumer Protection Directorate in Brussels. We have a member of our staff on secondment to the Consumer Protection Directorate, which is called DG Sanko, and I actually had a drink with her in Brussels a couple of weeks ago. I asked her how she was getting on. She said it was fine, it was very interesting. And I said, you know, how are your colleagues? She said, well, they're very interesting. She said, completely different people from the ones I normally meet because they're all vets. I thought she was making some kind of joke, but it turned out not, because the DG Sanko is actually, his prime role has been in food safety, in which I gather it's done a perfectly respectable job across Europe, but it is now engaged, and the vets are engaged in writing a consumer credit directive, which actually will have very fundamental implications for financial markets in the United Kingdom. So we have a series of overlapping and cross-cutting directives which can produce a less than clear legal environment for financial services. And also, and this is my sort of second sub-point on Europe, the constraints which apply to our legislation under, well, our regulation under the Financial Services and Markets Act, which are embodied, as I said, in these principles of good regulation, are not incorporated into the European processes. Now, the so-called Lamfalussy group, which some of you may have heard of, which reported a couple of years ago on financial regulation in Europe and how it was developed, did recommend similar principles for adoption in the EU, but they've not been taken up actively by the Commission. So on a number of occasions, we have found ourselves required to implement directives in London which would frankly not pass a cost-benefit test, as we are required to do with our domestic procedures, and which would not, in our view, meet our proportionality requirement. Understandably, the financial industry here finds it quite difficult to distinguish clearly between regulatory requirements which emerge from the FSA under the FSMA and those which emerge from the FSA under the FSAP. Now, of course, any city lawyer worth her salt would immediately spot the difference, but I have to tell you that there are other less fortunate folk who struggle with this problem. And the consequence is that our regime is not so tidy or so easily justifiable as it would be if it depended only on the Financial Services and Markets Act. Now, we must all hope, therefore, that the trumpeted benefits of the single financial market are sufficiently large as to dominate this disadvantage. But since there is no cost-benefit analysis attached to the Financial Sector Action Plan, we cannot prove the point one way or the other. My third point is of a slightly different nature. One problem we have run into recently is some resistance in the market to our outflow of consultation papers. Now, perhaps we've not helped ourselves by our thorough approach to consultation, or indeed perhaps by our rigid numbering system, which tells you that we are now up to consultation paper number 188. And I think it would be fair to acknowledge that a species of consultation fatigue has set in the market. Now, we do our best, I would have to say, to minimise the volume and the complexity, but consultation is built into the Financial Services and Markets Act, and on balance, I'm quite sure that it adds value. But my point this evening is not really about the volume, but about the care we need to take in interpreting the responses and indeed the potential problems of a requirement to regulate after a formal consultation process. Because what we are required to do is, according to these objectives and principles, to set out any proposals that we have for changes in the regulation, to allow a consultation period, then to publish a feedback response to all the consultations received, to explain in a reasoned way why we are not necessarily taking all the points, and then we may proceed. Two general points, however, strike me about the responses we receive, and these may seem blatantly obvious, but they are rarely made. First, we only receive responses from firms which exist. Now, in some cases, that does not matter. But if we take, for example, our current consultation on soft commissions in broking industry, on payment for research, and the way in which brokers generally are remunerated, the responses have all come, not surprisingly, from firms who are currently in the market. And they argue that the result of the proposed changes might be a significant diminution in their ability to fund research, on the grounds that if they identify to their clients precisely what they're paying for, in other words, they separately itemize, as we're suggesting, trading costs, commission, and other services like investment research, screens, Reuters screens, tickets for Glyndebourne, and all the other things which are paid for out of this commission, that people, their investors, would then buy less of it. And they say that might be a terribly bad idea because it would reduce the amount of research that was undertaken, and investors would thereby be disadvantaged. This is a slightly curious argument in my view because it does presuppose a degree of myopia on the part of investors. I mean, it assumes that investors don't know what they want and wouldn't make rational decisions if they were invited to pay for these different services. But let's set that aside, because one consequence of unbundling of payments for transactions and research might well be that investors chose to buy less research from the brokers through whom they passed their transactions, but they might, of course, choose to buy research elsewhere. and they might find better value and indeed greater independence of research as a result from new boutiques which might establish themselves if these payments were separately identified and a separate market for research were allowed to flourish. So new research firms may well emerge if the market is liberalised in the way suggested in our consultation paper. Yet by definition, we do not receive responses from these as yet non-existent firms. A second and related source of potential structural bias in the evolution of a consultation-based system is the imbalance of resources between financial firms and investors, particularly retail investors. During the legislative consultation in particular, the weight of representations from financial firms by comparison with investor groups was absolutely enormous. And those financial firms could, of course, typically afford to commission the major city law firms to work on the legislation on their behalf. That is similarly true in relation to some of our rule consultations at present. Yet investors, particularly retail investors, do not have the resources to commission that kind of response. Now, of course, we do not discount these responses just because they happen to come from a city law firm, and I can assure you that we read them carefully. But we do need to recognise the imbalance of resources when we assess the totality of the consultation response and determine the right way forward, and we need to take account of this structural bias in favour of the status quo. Now, in making these assessments, we are able to draw on a significant body of legal advice within the FSA. We employ around 100 legally qualified people in the authority, though some quite understandably prefer not to admit that openly. But the important point about our in-house lawyers, and this is my fourth point, is not so much their number as the way in which they're used. Interestingly, the role of lawyers in the predecessor organisations was very different from one to another. For example, no lawyers were directly involved in insurance regulation, though the regulators of insurance in the Department of Trade and Industry could draw on the central legal services of the DTI if they wished. The Bank of England had grown a very small cadre of lawyers to support the banking supervisors, in fact, in response to Lord Bingham's recommendations in the report following the closure of BCCI. While by contrast, in the investment regulators, lawyers played a much more central role. Though it's fair to say that even in our investment regulators like the SAIB or the SFA or IMRO, lawyers were never so dominant in the staffing mix as they are in the SEC, or indeed in continental European securities regulators, most of whose staff are legally qualified, indeed almost all of the professional staff. In constructing the FSA, we therefore needed to make some decisions about how our legal support would be structured, and more importantly, how it would be integrated with the other disciplines. In practice, what has happened is that most, though not all, of our legally qualified staff are either in the enforcement division or in the general counsel's area. But we staff our enforcement teams with a mixture of legally qualified and other staff, notably forensic accountants. As much of the investigative work we undertake can benefit significantly from that kind of discipline. Much of it actually lends itself to the disciplines of forensic accountancy rather than to the law. The general counsel's division are typically not directly engaged in enforcement activity. Their roles are to interpret and apply the legislation, to help develop new regulations under the Financial Services and Markets Act, to manage a lot of that process I've just been describing, and to ensure the legal integrity of our handbook of rules and guidance, and to support supervisors in their day-to-day work. And our experience is that we get the best value from our legal resource if we ensure a lively interaction between lawyers and those from other disciplines, notably economics, accountancy, and other types of financial qualification. If that interaction is to work well, it requires lawyers who are innovative and indeed active. And one important lesson we've learned from our assessment of the old regulatory regime is that if legal powers are not used, they can atrophy. Yet in many cases, supervisors can be reluctant to invoke legal powers in their day-to-day business. So we've explicitly tasked our General Counsel Division with an assessment of how best to use the legal provisions in the Act, which were put there by Parliament for a purpose, after all, and to ensure that supervisors are aware of the full potential of the legal toolkit at their disposal. We think, therefore, that we've found an interesting new approach to integrating legal thinking with the other disciplines which make up the regulatory cocktail. Now, only time will tell whether this is the best solution, but we are encouraged so far. And one particular aspect of the contribution lawyers can make to the regulatory mix leads me to my fifth, and you'll be pleased to know, final point. The overall philosophy of the FSA is founded on a risk-based approach to regulation. We aim to identify those risks which can threaten our statutory objectives, and at the level of the firm, that typically means risks which threaten its financial stability. So we have a risk model which we apply to all of the firms in our care. There are 12,000 of them, and we look at a variety of different sorts of risk, ranging from market risk, credit risk, operational risk, etc. And in articulating this new approach to risk, we have looked at the causes of failures of firms in the past, and indeed the causes of unexpected losses, even if they didn't necessarily lead to complete firm failure, and indeed at the causes of market disruptions, which themselves had damaging consequences of financial markets or created collateral damage elsewhere. Now, it is fair to say, if you do that analysis of the past, that the most significant and life-threatening risk for most financial firms does frankly remain credit risk, which is a very traditional source of failure in banks and elsewhere. But in an increasing number of instances, we have identified legal risk as an important contributing factor in financial crises of varying kinds. Now, to explain that, let me just give you one or two examples. One thinks, for example, of the Hammersmith and Fulham interest rate swaps affair, indeed, which I notice one or two people here this evening who were involved. That, in fact, was a case in which I was intimately involved as controller of the Audit Commission, which was one of the more exciting aspects of that clearly very dull role. That crisis was, of course, precipitated by a House of Lords ruling to the effect that interest rate swap contracts carried out by local authorities were ultra vires. That was not something which was expected by the market, and slightly surprisingly, it was not something which the market had sought to take advice about before one US investment bank sought to question the vires of the council. And in fact, it was an American who arrived in London and who was very concerned about the size of one council's transactions with his bank and called us up one afternoon. Indeed, I was in the office, and he called up and asked to speak to me, because he said my name, but he spoke to our head of accounting, and said, who's this guy Hammersmith? And so we said, well, we explained. He said, this guy Hammersmith's real big in this market. Does he know what he's doing?
Definitely.
And this whole crisis was precipitated from that phone call by an American who arrived from New York and sought to ask a few questions about just what the basis of these transactions was. The Equitable Life closure was, of course, also precipitated by a House of Lords ruling on the treatment of their guaranteed annuity policies, and indeed on the interpretation of the word guarantee in those policies. A third and even more topical international example is the litigation flowing from the Enron debacle, where banks and insurers are contesting the validity of a variety of bond and reinsurance contracts in a series of actions which are providing a very good living to quite a lot of lawyers in New York. An interesting dimension of these cases is the cultural clash between the typical approach taken by banks in the event of disputes, which has traditionally been pay now, sue later, and the traditional attitude of insurers, which, let me put this delicately, is to seek legal certainty before writing a check. Now, there are many other cases I could cite, but the point I draw from them is one of general application, which doesn't relate specifically to the circumstances of any one of these cases I've quoted. But it is that firms should explicitly consider legal risk as one of the risks which they should actively manage and for which they should seek mitigation. And we are, frankly, regularly surprised by firms who are operating on the basis of an implicit assumption about the legal position of the contracts to which they're a party without seeking to clarify that position. Now, of course, we understand that not every contract can be litigated up to the House of Lords as a theoretical matter before it's signed, but firms seem surprisingly willing to proceed without the benefit of counsel's opinion, even in what is known to be heavily contested territory. Now, I'm uncomfortably aware, as I say this, that I may be accused of encouraging the expensive practice of opinion shopping and giving an unjustified boost to the turnover of London's legal industry. But my motives are pure. They are to reduce the volume of litigation, normally a more lucrative source of business for the legal profession, and also to reduce the risk of financial failure. Now, these 5 points, I guess, don't lead themselves to a neat summary conclusion, except perhaps to say that at the FSA, I think we have benefited from the extensive interaction we've had with the London legal community over the last 5 years, even those small parts of it which, unlike you, did not benefit from an LSE education. Thank you.
All I can say, Howard, is keep up the good work. Howard has very kindly agreed to answer some questions, and we've got a little time. If they can be kept short and to the point, and don't become speeches, that would be very helpful. I just need a hand. Yes, sir.
To what extent does your system of regulation of the markets depend upon private enforcement actions similar to class actions brought on behalf of stockholders or others in the United States?
As little as possible, I think, is what we would say. I mean, our system has been devised in an attempt to give investors alternative routes within the regulatory system to seek redress. Our enforcement approach is typically designed to secure redress for investors as the prime objective, and we emphasize redress and compensation well above fines. For example, the largest fine levied in the UK regulatory system so far by any of the regulators was £4 million. But the compensation for the pensions mis-selling review, which we required firms to pay, was £11 billion, which I think probably the largest consumer compensation exercise probably we think ever undertaken anywhere in the world. And that pensions mis-selling review was, if you like, conceived as the regulatory equivalent of a class action, in the sense that we defined a category of investors to whom we believed personal pensions had been missold and defined a compensation approach and negotiated an agreement to that by the industry. And essentially the fines were then imposed where firms were dilatory in actually delivering this compensation package. And we also, alongside the regulator, have a single financial ombudsman service, which is designed to handle individual cases. So we can deal with class cases within the regulatory system, and the individual cases can be dealt with by the ombudsman. And the ombudsman scheme is one which is binding on the firm if they enter the scheme and allow the scheme to handle a case. So I think missold investors or damaged investors
would in this country typically look to the regulator or to the ombudsman to deal with their case. Now, that is not to say that there is no place for class actions in our system, and indeed there are one or two class actions underway, and particularly in areas where perhaps the regulatory system does not entirely comfortably cover the damage for which people are claiming compensation. Now, whether those actions will be successful, I'm not quite sure, because the courts in this country have typically looked to the regulatory system to define what reasonable behaviour is. But certainly, so far, we have had much less in the way of class actions, partly because the regulatory system is conceived in the way I've described. Yes, sir.
On Monday, I read that 57% of a sample of 1,000 people expressed confidence or trust in the FSA as a regulator and safeguarder of their investments. On Tuesday, I read that Anne Abraham suggested that our expectations were perhaps rather over high. I wondered whether you were able to comment upon this and to comment upon some of those principles at the beginning of FSMA, which on the one hand suggest that we should beware as buyers, but on the other hand grades us into consumers of different degrees of sophistication. I wonder whether we are still going to be as confident as we were on Monday or whenever the poll was done, and whether we might not actually find ourselves ceasing to resort to redress at home, but maybe starting to grasp outside, possibly going back to European human rights legislation and suggesting that some of our rights have been impaired.
Well, I saw both of those things, obviously. I've actually tried to get hold of the source of the first one, which was a surprise to me. I didn't realize there was such a poll, and so far no one's been prepared to divulge this, so it may well be, like many things in the FT, simply made up. But I can't really comment on it, because I don't even know whether the other 43% were saying that they had absolutely no confidence in the FSA, or that they never heard of the FSA or anything. So I have no idea whether this is to be regarded as a good result or a bad result, I'm afraid. I can't really illuminate that. The Parliamentary Ombudsman report published on Tuesday was a very interesting report, actually. Obviously, in many respects, we were bound to welcome it, since it was a fairly comprehensive not guilty verdict on the particular charge that what we did in relation to Equitable was damaging to investors, and she, you know, she rejected that charge. But she did cover the judgment on the particular case with an interesting short essay on expectations of the prudential regulatory system. This is particularly interesting because it really is at the core of the decisions that a regulator has to make. Now, to put it, let me put it in a couple of ways. I mean, we could, as a regulator, pretty much guarantee no failure in the life insurance industry. And we could do that by requiring all life companies to hold 100% of their assets in the form of gilt-edged and cash. Now, I say we could do that. Probably we could be challenged then on the grounds of proportionality and damaging innovation and competition, etc. I mean, we might lose, it might not pass that kind of test, but in principle, we could do such a thing, and that would reduce the incidence of failure to approaching zero, and it would also guarantee you a small negative annual return, I think, because the costs would be, I think, would just about offset the yield. As soon as you allow companies to invest, life insurance companies to invest in risky assets, then you admit of the possibility of some kind of failure in that system. Now, in fact, I will technically say Equitable Life has not actually failed. It's not insolvent. It's still paying out. But, I mean, it's closed to new business is what has actually happened to it. And setting that risk appetite is really at the core of what the financial regulator does. And yet, there is relatively little guidance to us on where we should set that point. In Parliament, when we were going through our legislation, we deliberately, quite explicitly, published a paper called Our New Approach to Regulation, in which we explicitly said that our interpretation of the legislation and of the objectives and the principles set out was that it was pointing to us towards a non-zero failure regime. And I would strongly maintain that that is what it says. And if you construe the objectives and the caveat emptor principle and the principles of good regulation together, it's hard to produce a parliamentary will in favour of zero failure. I mean, it clearly anticipates that markets will be allowed to operate, and if you allow financial markets to operate and to take risk, then it can't be a race in which all shall win prizes. So we admit the possibility of failure in the regime. But the issue of where you set that rate of failure is absolutely at the core of what the regulator is doing. What the Parliamentary Ombudsman pointed to was that in the cases put to her, clearly that was not the way investors saw it. I mean, their way in which they saw it, the policyholders of Equitable Life, was there had been a failure of a company, as I say, using that term in a colloquial way rather than a legal way, and therefore that was a regulatory failure. You know, that was, and the arguments were not really advanced, really that much more sophisticated than that. I mean, that was, therefore, it was an open and shut case. The company had failed, the regulator had failed. And that the notion that the regulator was providing a kind of qualified assurance, or a sort of bounded assurance, if you like, was one which was not very easily understood. And what she was pointing to, and I think she's performed a public service in opening this debate up, is to explain that no system of prudential regulation can be giving that kind of assurance. And it cannot ensure that savings in any particular life company or pension fund or fund management operation are safe. And I personally welcome the fact that that debate has been opened up in this way, because essentially the regulator can only react to the kind of public mood, and I think that's different in different countries. I mean, actually, the appetite for risk is different here from in some other countries. I mean, so there are some other countries in Europe who explicitly say that they aim to avoid any failure of an insurance company. And in fact, as a result, they do have asset allocation policies which are very different from the ones we have had here. As a result, their investors small investors have not benefited from the rise in the equity markets over the last 30 or 40 years. At the moment, of course, they're feeling rather better about that. But over a long period of time, their small investors have not benefited from that because collective investment schemes have had a much smaller equity market exposure. So that's the essence of the regulatory judgment, and it's frankly not an easy one to make.
Well, it's partly to do with the role, I suppose. I mean, it's a bit like saying there's no point in having non-executive directors because you can never cut out fraud.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's a valid proposition. Sorry. Joanne.
Thank you. Turning from your comments on what a regulator can't do, if I can turn to what a regulator shouldn't do in relation to the project of regulating legal risk, would you agree with the following? It's important to avoid creating regulatory distortions because some measure of legal risk is normal and proper and should be encouraged. In London, certainly, the financial markets are tremendously innovative and law follows practice, sometimes by a considerable distance. The distance gets larger the more innovative finance is. And provided there's no possible criminality, also perhaps if there's no clear consumer protection concern, a regulator wouldn't want to force a commercial firm into a conservative approach to commercial legal risk.
I think you invite me to agree with that proposition, and I think I probably I probably do agree with that proposition. I think what I would say is, and I think the cases to which I was drawing attention emphasize that, and I hope you would agree with this counter-proposition, that as a major firm, particularly one acting on behalf of small investors, you wouldn't want to bet the ranch on a legal risk which you had not sought to assess or mitigate. And so, yes, we perfectly accept that there will be uncertainties, that people will be operating in innovative areas, they will be taking risks. But, I mean, again, to take perhaps back to the Equitable case, you wouldn't want to bet the whole firm on a particular interpretation, ideally. And that, I think, is the problem, and that is what we are trying to do. We are trying to say, are there companies who are operating in areas of legal uncertainty where an adverse judgment on something which is moot would clearly threaten the viability of the firm and particularly damage the integrity of the financial system and create collateral damage for innocent investors. So that would be what our supervisors would be looking for, not to say, you know, you do have some legal uncertainty and you should seek to remove it, but are you operating in a way which could damage the viability of the firm, retail investors in particular, and indeed the stability of the financial system?
You're the next.
The logic of the Financial Services Action Plan is there'll be an integrated European financial area. That leads me to three questions. The first is, does that also lead to a logic of a European regulator? And if so, second question, what style of regulation and especially of prudential supervision would you envisage in it? And third, in view of what you told us about the European Commission, do you have any advice on my dog's diet?
First point, I think it doesn't necessarily, because if you look at the way regulation in Europe is typically organized, we have European directives which are then implemented at local level by national regulators. So we have a European regulation on cleanliness of beaches, but we don't have Italian beach inspectors in Blackpool, something for which they are very grateful, I think. So there isn't in principle anything wrong with having a single financial market with mutual recognition and yet with the regulation handled at local level. It may be that there are certain aspects of the way in which a financial market would develop in Europe which could at some point justify European-wide regulation. And I'm thinking, for example, of perhaps clearing and settlement systems, which in some ways are sometimes rather difficult to know quite where they're located in the sense, and they may be kind of utilities. And in the US, they are constructed as utilities. In Europe, that's not the case at the moment. But if they were, then you might say, well, that could sensibly be regulated in one place. We have a belief that in the medium term, we are going to need something like a European consolidated tape, for example, to pull together information on equity transactions from different markets in order to facilitate the monitoring of market manipulation, market abuse, etc. And again, that might be something which would be sensibly and rationally handled at the center. So I take the view that the principle should be subsidiarity and regulation close to the markets, but that on a case-by-case basis, we may wish bottom-up to construct some pan-European networks and mechanisms which may facilitate this single market. I don't, at this point, see any particular argument for a single prudential regulator on a European basis. In the banking system globally, works on principles of mutual recognition, and it works on the whole. You know, you're always nervous about saying this because there's a huge bank failure announced in tomorrow's newspaper, but on the whole, it works reasonably well on the basis of, in fact, Basel principles, not European principles at all. They're global principles of banking supervision, and we mutually recognize US banks here, Canadian banks, Japanese banks, Swiss banks, just as well as we do German or French banks. So I don't think, personally, that the creation of a single financial market necessarily means that you need a single prudential regulator. So for the moment, I think that as the state of the market, for the state of the European single financial market, what we've got is perfectly reasonable and adequate. But I have an open mind about how that might develop into some pan-European regulatory functions, particularly of things where you really do need to take a pan, a pan-European view, like, say, clearing and settlement or transactions monitoring. I think that picks up your first two questions. We feed our dog something called science diet. I've no idea what's in it, but she seems quite happy.
Yes, sir.
If after the setting up of a single capital market for the whole of Europe, for the European Union, the laws applicable to such single capital market are also made very similar, if not identical. I'm not talking about a super regulator. I'm just talking about making the laws very, very similar. Do you think there is a small chance that there is a danger that London might cease to be the main financial center for the whole of Europe, because somebody wanting to make a bond issue might as well go to Brussels or Paris and do it, because currently the English law offers a lot of advantages. If the laws are made very similar or identical, do you think that advantage might go away?
Well, I think probably technically one ought to distinguish between a regulatory system and a single legal system. And indeed, one other obstacle to a single European regulator is the fact that if you did have one, it would nonetheless need to enforce in the different court systems of the different member states. And since we're quite a long way away from having a common court system, a common legal system in Europe, if you put together a single European regulator, it would immediately need 15 different enforcement divisions trained in the different laws of different member states in order to enforce itself. So I think you've got to distinguish between financial regulation and the legal systems. The two interact in rather complicated ways. As for the impact of a common regulatory system on Europe, I think this is difficult ex ante to know quite what the effect will be. I would observe at the moment that so far the effect of growing financial integration in Europe has typically been to strengthen London's position in the area of mobile wholesale business. It hasn't made a lot of difference in retail markets yet, actually, but retail markets tend to be rather stubbornly national and local for the moment. But where the business is mobile, it has tended to gravitate towards London. So London's market share of foreign exchange, etc., has in fact grown in recent years as Europe's financial integration has grown. And indeed, there's some logic to that because, they're in a market in which there are few barriers to where you do business. Actually, there is a kind of first mover advantage and a sort of winner takes all advantage. People will tend to gravitate to the centre in which there are the strongest, in which there is the strongest critical mass, where the access to investors is easier, where the capital raising process is easier and more streamlined. So I don't think there is much of an argument for saying that the common rules will necessarily cause the market to disaggregate. I think they could just as well cause it to agglomerate as to disaggregate. On your specific point about bonds, that was addressed in the context of the prospectus directive, which has been agreed this week, actually. And what has been agreed there is that for bond issues, you don't have to go to your home regulator. You can go to any regulator. So I think the likelihood is that people issuing euro bonds will continue to go largely to London and Luxembourg and not to go for prospectus approval to their home regulator, because they will be allowed to go across border. For equities, the prospectus directive still assumes that you will go to your home regulator for a prospectus approval. Frankly, at the moment, that's not going to make a big difference, because there are not really that many non-UK companies who come first to the FSA to have their prospectus approved. We've never yet had a Greek prospectus come to us for approval, although there are companies who go and list simultaneously in Athens and London. And so quite a lot of the business is then done in London. So I don't actually see the prospectus directive as it's just been agreed having much impact on the location of financial activity at all.
Beware Greeks bearing gifts, I think I would caution. I didn't mean that in any way offensively. It's time for one more question. Yes, sir.
I don't know if you saw The Economist this week. It did a sort of a special edition or some special stuff in regard to its 160th anniversary. And it spoke about shareholder activism not being perhaps as advanced as it maybe should be. And I think they used the term a vacuum exists. Is there anything that you think as the departing or retiring chairman of the FSA you would wish to comment on in regard to the level of shareholder activity, let's say?
Well, it's not primarily our responsibility, though I think as a general principle we would believe that more active shareholders is likely to result in a livelier and better disciplined market. And indeed, what we have seen, if you look at again, looking at an analysis of failures in financial firms in particular that we've done, then often it is things like over-dominant individuals in firms not challenged effectively by boards and associated with a lack of interest really taken by shareholders in corporate governance as long as the firm was doing fine. And that has often been quite damaging, actually, for long-term shareholder interests because people have acquiesced in unconventional corporate governance, obvious dominance by an individual treating the company as a personal fiefdom, which frequently, in the end, has ended in tears. And yet where, year after year, the shareholders have simply not bothered to vote their shares on the corporate governance or on the accounts or anything else. So as a general principle, we would think that the markets will work better if you have shareholders who do take an interest, because otherwise you can have as many codes of good practice and corporate governance as you like, but if there's no one really engaged with them on the shareholding side, then they are rather empty and formalistic. So in a general way, we would be in favour of shareholder activism. Though I would caution in one respect, as I was talking to one large institutional investor recently of a rather cynical frame of mind, who said, well, actually on corporate governance, you know, we've decided that we're going to vote our shares internationally. And in fact, what we do is, in the UK, we vote resolutely against any combined chairman and chief executive and in favour of a split. In the US, we vote cheerfully in favour of combined chief executives. In continental Europe, we vote cheerfully in favour of two-tier boards with employees and with audit committees with employees on them. And so it goes on. And essentially, a lot of these institutional investors who are now global vote according to the kind of norms of each market, which may have no consistency in their approach whatsoever. So I have a degree of scepticism about some of the approach taken by shareholders, even where they are taking the trouble at least to vote their shares.
Well, that's been, if I may say so, fascinating, and I hope everybody has enjoyed that. And it's marvellous to get the inside view on these extremely interesting developing business issues and city issues. And I doubt very much indeed if we could get such an in-depth view either from anybody else here, and I also suspect we wouldn't get a better view from equivalents in New York or elsewhere in the world or in Tokyo. We're very, very grateful, Howard, for your informative explanations, your responses to the questions, and for everything you've said, with the possible exception of all the offensive remarks you make about my profession. But there it is. I have entire sympathy for it, and I respect it. But can I just remind everybody that Robinson Room, third floor of this building, there's a drinks reception, and everybody is welcome to come and join us. And could I ask you all to thank Howard Davis, for giving us this lecture.